This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
It is very clear that both, unfortunately, are severely breaking the ceasefire. Of course, the RSF are more on the ground, more in the houses, more in the hospitals, more in the street.
That's Nasreen El-Sayam, a Sudanese activist who fled Khartoum 2 weeks ago and is now in London on the unreliable ceasefires between the army and paramilitary forces. Details coming up. Also, Zimbabwe sets August 23rd for presidential and parliamentary elections. And today is World No Tobacco Day. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. Shelling continued in Khartoum today after the Sudanese army pulled out of ceasefire talks brokered by Saudi Arabia and the United States in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. The army accused its rival, the paramilitary rapid support forces, of failing to honor their commitments. A Sudanese government official told the French news agency AFP the army walked out because, quote, the rebels have never implemented a single one of the provisions of a short-term ceasefire, which required their withdrawal from hospitals and residential buildings. Sudanese activist Nasreen El-Sayam, who escaped from Khartoum 2 weeks ago, says both sides have violated a truce, but she tells VOA's Carol Van Dam that the RSF is doing it more in plain sight.
It is very clear that both, unfortunately, are severely breaking the ceasefire. But the other part is that how much the civilians and how much the humanitarian workers are impacted in this situation. And of course, the RSF are more on the ground, more in the houses, more in the hospitals, more in the street. They are the ones who meet the normal people who are walking or trying to escape Khartoum or trying to come back to their houses to collect some of the stuff, etc., etc. So yes, from a point of view of a normal person, it is the RSF who is definitely severely violating the ceasefire.
What does it mean for the prospects of peace that the army says it has pulled out of the talks? I mean, were the talks progressing to a point where people were thinking, oh, this just might happen?
Well, people thought that the discussions and the negotiations in Saudi Arabia might actually have a good result. And everyone had huge hopes that maybe by Eid, because the other Eid we have in Islam, Al-Adha Eid, is coming very soon. It's around 30th or 29th of June. So everyone was hoping that maybe by Eid we can be home with our families celebrating the Eid as normal. But no, obviously for someone who have a bit of long vision of the situation, it was not going to happen. The conflict between the army and RSF is not on a negotiable things. The conflict between them is the conflict of a zero sum. It's either we stay or you stay. And in these kinds of conflicts, in these types, normally negotiation is just a process to gain more time and to rearrange your lines and rearrange your plans and maybe try to figure it out more. But for me personally, I was never hopeful in the negotiations happening in Saudi Arabia because I know the personality of the two leaders of the two armies, either the RSF or the Sudanese army. Both of them are very self-centric, and unfortunately, this war is also around them. Hemeti wants Burhan and Burhan wants Hemeti. So there is no negotiable conditions. There is no other needs but the heads of the two armies. And of course, the commitments of the negotiations for me were not also realistic, especially in the terms of the RSF. Going out to their camps, leaving the houses. I mean, it's just like asking the RSF to go and be a sitting duck to be hunted by the army. Of course, they will not go back to their camps because then the Air Force will just drop a few bombs on them and that's it for them.
That's a nice reading, Els. I am a chair of the UN Secretary General's Youth Advisory Group on Climate Change and chairperson of the Sudan Youth Organization on Climate Change. She was speaking to Carol Van Dam from London. Intercommunal violence and fighting between Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces in West Darfur state have intensified in recent days, according to reports. Witnesses who have escaped the city of Jenina say their hometown is being ripped apart. Henry Wilkins reports from Adre, Chad.
It's around 8 a.m. in Adre, Chad, a town on the country's border with Sudan. Chadian citizens are returning from Jenina, the capital of West Darfur state, which some experts say has experienced more intense fighting than Sudan's capital, Khartoum, in recent weeks. One returnee spoke to VOA just after crossing the border from Sudan. She asked to remain anonymous to protect her family's safety. She says the problem started at the beginning of Ramadan. They burned houses and killed a lot of people. They started on the outskirts of the city and then moved into the interior neighborhoods. They robbed the market, they broke everything, especially in stores and markets. They took everything from them. The returnees say they fled the city under the cover of darkness to avoid being shot. Moments later, horse-drawn carts carrying Sudanese refugees fleeing Jenina arrive. Sudanese refugee Abdul Anasser Abdallah Adam described how much of the city was affected by the fighting. He says the entire city has been affected. All the military campsites have been burned. There's nothing left. Everything has been destroyed and robbed. All the city facilities have been destroyed, including hospitals, police stations, schools, etc. Fighting between Sudanese armed forces and the paramilitary rapid support forces, which this video purports to show, is tearing the city apart. It's unclear how many people have been killed in Jenina since the fighting began. Since May 19th, the cell phone networks in the city have stopped working altogether, leading many to worry about the fate of relatives and associates still there. Mathilde Vu of the Norwegian Refugee Council say the aid group fears the worst for its colleagues in the city.
West Darfur has seen very high level of violence over this past month. There's been several attacks. There's been complete mayhem, basically, in the middle of the city with shelling of residential areas, of snipers targeting people. There's been completely burned down of displacement camps, and a lot of people have had to flee somewhere in the city. But nowhere is actually safe.
The population of Jenina was around 250,000, but tens of thousands have fled to refugee sites in Chad, like Barotta. Refugees say it's dangerous to leave the city and dangerous to stay. So many people simply don't know what to do. Aliona Sininko from the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, says the humanitarian situation is dire.
Access to food is getting increasingly difficult. About 3 million people that were there displaced even before the current crisis. So people, they have been through a lot already, and their resilience have been weakened by all these multiple challenges. And now they are facing this new round of violence where they have to flee their homes again.
Many Sudan watchers on social media complain that media attention has focused broadly on fighting in Khartoum, giving less attention to the intense fighting in West Darfur. Henry Wilkins for VOA News, Adra, Chad.
The Zimbabwe government says it summoned the acting U.S. ambassador to Zimbabwe over an ad urging citizens in the Southern African nation to register to vote. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
In a statement late Tuesday, Livit Mugejo, spokesman for Zimbabwe's Minister of Foreign Affairs, said Elaine French, the chargé d'affaires at the U.S. Embassy in Harare, had been summoned by Harare over several advertisements shared on social media this month by the U.S. Embassy. Mugejo said the most notable post was captioned, "Register to vote and make sure your voice is heard," among other tweets. Mugejo said French met with Rufina Chikava, Zimbabwe's acting Secretary for Foreign Affairs, who expressed concern over the U.S. mission's election-related social media posts bordering on activism and meddling in Zimbabwe's internal affairs. Maggie Riggs, the spokeswoman for the U.S. Embassy in Harare, confirmed the meeting between French and Chikaba and said there was no problem with the ads which egged Zimbabwe.
We stand by our recent social media post calling for peace during the election season. These neutral, apolitical messages featured the work of Zimbabwean artists who wanted to engage their fellow youth on the importance of peace during the election process. Elections are a fundamental part of a functioning democracy. All Zimbabweans deserve this chance to choose their future safely. The United States does not support any single candidate or party. We strongly support a peaceful and transparent process that reflects the will of the people of Zimbabwe. Our embassy will continue to urge peace, transparency, and inclusivity in Zimbabwe.
Alexander Rusero, who heads the International Relations Studies at Africa University in Zimbabwe, says President Emmerson Mnangagwa was justified in summoning French.
An embassy is simply situated in a country within the interest of furthering the host country's interests, are not necessarily bothered by the internal dynamics of that state. So there are no relations that are going to be strained, because the Americans, they are better placed to know what diplomacy entails and what diplomacy is all about.
President Mnangagwa has not yet announced the date for the elections expected in August. Columbus Mavungam, VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Zimbabwe says presidential, parliamentary and local elections will be held August 23rd amid opposition allegations of violence and intimidation against government critics. Government critics say they fear a repeat of past election violence. The Government Gazette announcement also set October 2nd for a presidential runoff if required. President Emmerson Mnangagwa is seeking a second full term. He replaced Robert Mugabe in a 2017 coup that then won election the following year. He has tried to present himself as a reformer, despite accusations that he is even more repressive than the man he helped remove from power. Mnangagwa is expected to face a strong challenge from Nelson Chamisa, head of the main opposition party, Citizens Coalition for Change. Chamisa narrowly lost to Mnangagwa in 2018. Zimbabwe has faced severe economic problems for years and has been under U.S. sanctions for two decades over human rights abuses. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. For this year's World No Tobacco Day, the World Health Organization has appealed to governments to stop subsidizing tobacco farming and support more sustainable crops that could feed millions of people. Statistics from the WHO show that tobacco use kills more than 7 million people each year. James Shimanayula reports from Nairobi.
In its new report entitled Grow Food Not Tobacco, the World Health Organization highlights the hazards linked to the growing the leafy plant and the benefits of switching to more sustainable food crops for farmers, communities, economies, and the environment. The study finds that the tobacco industry traps farmers in a cycle of debt and propagates growing the crop by exaggerating its economic benefits and lobbying by front groups. Dr. Rudiger Kretsch is the Director of Health Promotion at the World Health Organization in Geneva.
Tobacco is of a huge harm to all our health. But in addition to that, tobacco contributes highly to food insecurity. Sadly enough, 350 million people face severe food insecurity. Countries where those people live actually use their fertile land to grow tobacco. We urge member states to stop that and to grow food instead of deadly crops. And we urge, as WHO member states also, to stop the subsidies they still give to tobacco growth.
Krech also cited the danger of pesticides to world health.
The people who work in the lands who grow tobacco, they actually consume as much nicotine as is contained in 50 cigarettes a day. That is especially harmful to people, to women who are pregnant, and, of course, to the 1 million children who are also working in the lands. So this is toxic, and we need to stop that toxic plants to be grown.
Dr. Krech turns to projects in Kenya and Zambia by the World Health Organization, and the World Food Program offers incentives to farmers to switch from tobacco crop to raising beans and other foods.
Tobacco industry also sucks these farmers into vicious cycles. They give small loans and then they have to repay those loans. So there's many people who want to do this in Kenya and now in Zambia to actually get to 5,000 farmers this year. We're preserving the environment, we're creating economic opportunities, and we're prioritizing health.
The World Health Organization says more than 3 million hectares of land in more than 120 countries are used to grow tobacco, as more than 300 million people globally face acute food insecurity. For VOA Africa News, this is James Shimanyula in Nairobi, Kenya.
U.S. President Joe Biden is urging Congress to pass a deal to raise the government's borrowing limit and prevent what could be a catastrophic default on U.S. debt repayments. Voting on the bill is set to start later today. Raising the debt limit is not only important for the United States, but for countries around the world, including African nations. Columbian University senior researcher Harry Verhoeven tells VOA's Carol Van Damme, if the U.S. defaults, it would send many African economies into a tailspin.
African countries heavily depend on their ability to export primarily commodities to richer countries, including to the United States, and they're very dependent on imports from outside the continent. And so anything that threatens the ability to import or export, and thereby to make these economies function for them and for the many producers within these economies to earn a living, to earn an income, and particularly the foreign exchange element of this, right? The key part of being able to export in particular is being able to get your hands on US dollars or euros or renminbi or another valuable foreign currency. If anything there happens, that immediately translates into a cost of living crisis for many people. Disposable incomes get hit.
All these African countries, they may have their own currency, but when they have to do imports and exports, they're not dealing with their own currency. So everything depends on the U.S. dollar and the stability of the U.S. dollar, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. International trade, especially international commodity trade, is still very heavily dollarized. Things like oil, of course, natural gas, but also many other kind of agricultural commodities. This is still very much done in U.S. dollars. And so when you get this kind of threat, both kind of from an importing perspective, the United States, which for a number of reasons may no longer demand African goods to the same extent if this deal were not to pass and you would have this kind of default, or because the fluctuations in the dollar itself and in its value would be profoundly destabilizing for many of these poor economies. And so that's why from the African continent, people may not understand the intricacies of the politics of this, of why this comes up so regularly and why Republicans are saying this and Democrats are saying that. But what they do know very much is that kind of the instability this risks triggering, the crisis of confidence it may lead to in the US dollar itself may have very profound repercussions from a trading standpoint, but also importantly from a debt standpoint. African countries owe debts to a lot of different outside actors, in different parts around the world, to China, to international organizations, to Europe, to the United States, etc. But again, a lot of that debt is denominated in U.S. dollars.
A vote is to be taken on Wednesday. The Congress will start acting on it. Do you think that between now and then, anything substantial will change that will, you know, upset the markets?
Very difficult to say. I mean, I have no particular read into what may or may not happen in markets. And I have the impression that most people in financial markets, including those, you know, in financing of imports and exports, are assuming that this will pass, that it is important enough for people not to hold it ransom to certain kinds of political considerations. But there's always the small risk, of course, that, as you say, that things don't work out, that they do go wrong. In that case, you know, again, the problem is from the standpoint of many African economies that there's not really kind of, if you like, a playbook that's readily available that would suggest, you know, here are the 10 steps that you can take to immediately kind of protect your economy or your exporters and your importers from the fallout of this. That really doesn't exist.
That's Harry Verhoeven, a senior researcher at Columbia University in New York. He was speaking to VOA's Carol Van Dam from Brussels, Belgium. A Kenyan aid group is using forensic image technology to help parents find their missing children. The Missing Child Kenya Foundation says it has assisted in the location or rescue of more than 1,000 children in Kenya since its founding 7 years ago. Victoria Munga has the story from Nairobi.
Veronica Nyambura recounts the night in April when her 14-year-old daughter Catherine Wangare disappeared from their home in Kenya's Kiambu County. She was on a school break then.
Catherine has said she wants to go and pick some onions outside and some coriander. Her sister was washing utensils and I was sitting in the room watching news. Then after 30 minutes, that was when her sister noticed Catherine has not come back home. We started looking for her.
Nyambura says her unceasing effort to find her daughter since then have been futile. Thousands of Kenyan parents like Nyambura are coping with the loss of children who disappeared because of kidnappings, violence, or went missing under other unclear circumstances. According to national data, at least 6,840 children have been reported missing since July of last year.
It is painful. It is traumatizing because we don't know what has happened to your girl. You don't know whether she is alive. You don't know whether she is dead.
It's a challenge Mariana Munyendo is rising to through her organization Missing Child Kenya. Using forensic image technology, she keeps the search for the children alive by progressing their last known image.
If a child went missing at age of 4, and right now it is 6 years later, they are 10 years old, and their physical features, their facial features have changed. And so while the public will have a poster of them then at 4 years old, right now they are 10 years old, so we might be looking out for a different child, a child that is looking different.
The foundation also distributes the image on social media and in communities in the hope that someone will recognize a missing child. Munyendo says her organization has helped locate 1,052 children and reunite them with their families since 2016. 28 others, however, were found dead, while another 151 children who were located were placed in government care. According to the International Center for Missing and Exploited Children, conflicts in countries are causing more children to separate from their parents and increasing the number of missing youngsters. Athena Morgan is the center's regional director.
They'd be going either in search of peace or because most of their family members have become victims. Probably they've been killed in the process or they're running away with their parents and they get separated.
To further aid the search for missing kids, the Kenyan government has set up helplines and toll-free numbers at the Directorate of Criminal Investigations where people can leave tips about suspicious activity. Such acts, along with the work of groups like Missing Child Kenya, are keeping alive the hopes of parents like Nyambura. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. Yehiyas Wohib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer Mokbilia Baro and our engineer Nashwan Kali, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.